You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome back to Stay Ahead, a BI Norwegian Business School podcast. This episode is part of the Strategy as Practice series. And today's episode will circle around strategic brand building. Today, I have the pleasure of having with me Knut Heie from Agra. He's been the CEO at Agra since 2020, where he took over, I believe, after your father. Knut has been with the group since 2009, and prior to that, working for, among others, Goldman Sachs. Knut also has an MBA from Harvard University. Welcome.
Thanks for showing an interest and thanks for having me.
Pleasure. I'm also joined by Ulf Andersson. Ulf is adjunct professor at the Department of Strategy here at BI and has been there since 2013. He's also a professor of business studies at the Mälardalen University in Sweden. Before joining BI, he was a professor of strategy and international management at CBS in Copenhagen, Denmark. His research interests are subsidiary development, knowledge governance and transfer, network theory, and strategy and management of multinational enterprises. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
My name is Thomas Borgen, and I'm an industrial PhD candidate at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI, and will be your host today. Knut, I think it's fair to say that very few, including the business community, have ever heard about Agra. But probably all have heard about the major brands you own, like Mills and Delikat in Norway, Foodmark in Sweden, and Stryns in Denmark. I think we owe the listeners a short overview of the group. Could you give us that?
Sure. I think first and foremost, we are a private, family-owned, Scandinavian, fast-moving consumer goods company. What we do is really we create, we manufacture, we market, and we sell what we think of as healthy, sustainable, tasty food products for Scandinavians. That's what we're really about. And the size of our business is that we're about 1,000 employees, and sales this year will be between 4.5 and 5 billion Norwegian kroners. It's become larger and larger, fortunately.
Excellent. And really looking to deep dive some more into some of the cues you gave us here. Ulf. Not yes. Against you, but being Swedish.
Sorry.
Yeah. Partly working in Norway, and for many years also in Denmark. And being a professor in international business, how different or alike, in your opinion, are the business culture in these three countries?
Well, as I'm not out in business myself, it's very difficult to say. But when you talk to managers, I mean, they are clearly aware of differences in the three countries. And I think it's particularly if you're a Norwegian, a Swede or a Dane, you see differences to the other. If you're British, you probably see much less of difference between the countries.
How would you respond to that, Knut? Because you are exactly in those three countries.
I think it's interesting. I mean, before I joined our group, I worked in London and in New York, and I worked with, you know, other nationalities across the globe, really. And first and foremost, when I came back and started working with Swedes and Danes, I thought that we're really similar. So we're more similar than we're dissimilar. So that's good, and it's quite easy. It's easy to cooperate and find a common theme across the countries. But like you said, there are differences. And I think it's important when managing people and teams and cooperating across these countries to be aware of those differences. And to me, I mean, you know, the Danes are typically the competition in Denmark is in general pretty cutthroat, and price is a very important theme a lot of the time. And the Danes really know how to negotiate, and both externally and internally. So I think that, you know, sometimes you think you have an agreement with everybody around the table, even internally with your colleagues. And then the next day, different things actually happen. And then, you know, you'll ask your Danish colleagues and they'll tell you, but this and that happened, so we had to adapt, you know? And that's kind of, to me, typical with the Danes. The Swedes are really consensus-driven to me. Yeah. So my experience is that the Swedes take more time, even than the Danes and the Norwegians, to debate amongst themselves, to find consensus, to get the real buy-in. And then once they get the buy-in, which tends to be later than what I, you know, what I prefer, then they really get going and they're good at execution. And then the Norwegians, you know, that's for you to say, I guess, Irv, but I find that we're a little more direct than the Swedes.
Yes, I would say so. Mm. I would say so. I mean, there are small differences, but they are pretty apparent when you, if you're an internal, you see them quite easily. But I think if you're, as I said, British or something, you find much more of commonalities, because of course we look at the differences.
And I think that's a good point. So I think it's what I hear, and I think also studies shows, and has written several books about this, is we sometimes look for the differences and not look for the commonalities.
Exactly.
And also what I think research tells us, it's probably more corporate culture which is different than necessarily the national cultures when you do M&A across. But it'll be interesting later to discuss, when you run a Nordic business like you do, do you deal with it or do you lead it differently? And how do you think about leadership in those countries? But we must not talk around the topic, which is about how to achieve a sustainable competitive advantage in a fast-moving consumer goods business, which you are leading. And as you mentioned, Knut, Agra has a long-standing brand in Scandinavia, or not actually a brand in itself, but owns a lot of brands, even though it started, I presume, with a brand. Can you just take us through the main strengths? What has kept Agra so successful running throughout this long history? And has this strength changed over time?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, in my day-to-day job, I think a lot about our competitive edge today. But the question really, you know, forces me to go back and think about the journey and since it all started. And this company is almost 140 years old. And when we think about how it stays, how it was relevant then and stays relevant today, I think that perhaps a key theme is our ability to evolve with the current times. So we've adapted and evolved as the times have really changed quite dramatically. And perhaps our ownership structure with a family, a long-term family ownership, also being led by the family, has been an asset for us in that respect. This company started out as a manufacturing company, just as, you know, seizing on an opportunity. There was not enough fat in society, and so margarine was created, and a guy with the same name as my name, back in 1895, built a factory and produced everything he could as efficiently as he could. But then, you know, a number of decades down the road, there were too many margarine producers in the world. There was a problem. There was overcapacity in the industry. And so there was a wave of consolidation. And Agra then turned from being a manufacturer to being a consolidator. And that was, you know, one or two generations down the road. And then later, we evolved into a fast-moving consumer goods company where brands and other aspects of the business became critical to evolve and to continue to be relevant. So I think it's evolved over time.
And it's interesting. What I hear Knut saying, Ulf, is something with ownership,
yes,
the strength of being family-owned, and also maybe he focuses a lot on adaptation, the ability to kind of adjust to the environment. What does theory tell us about those two topics?
I mean, with the ownership structure, I mean, it's basically upsides with being several different ones. You get sort of more perspectives and all those kind of things, a sounding board, which can help you in the adaptation. But at the same time, of course, I mean, the downside is that you might not have the drive and the stamina of pursuing what you actually want to pursue. And so they go sort of hand in hand. I mean the downsides with the family business and ownership might be that you actually are not able to adapt because you think it's like this and others see it in a different way, and they are right. But I mean, it's difficult to say that one is sort of preferable to another or in a particular industry. I think there are upsides and downsides, and playing on the upsides is the way to do it.
Mm. Following on that, being very successful since late 1800s, how do you get impulses as a family, and how do you accept getting outside impulses and reflections?
When we think, the way we operate and the way we think about our business is that we're not that different. I mean, we're a family-owned business and led by one person, but we're not that different to other companies. And we try to hold ourselves accountable to the same standards of professionalism and the targets that we set that, you know, any other company, a public company, if you will. And today, I'm the only one in the family working in the business. I'm the only one going there every day, holding an executive or other role in the company. But we have family members on the board. So on the two main branches who own the business, they're represented with four people on the board. And then we have external resources on the board as well with relevant industry and financial experience. So they're a sounding board for us on strategic matters, obviously. And then I have 999 other colleagues who are not part of the family who challenge me, I hope. At least I want to be challenged. And who are, you know, making them their own professional careers and see Agra as an important stepping stone in their career, or hopefully somewhere they want to stay for a long time. So I don't see us operationally as very different from any other types of businesses.
Can I pose a question? Because it's interesting in this particular situation to think about how the subunits, I mean the brands to some extent, mm-hmm. who are more or less strong in the different countries, how they feed into new ideas, new strategies, I mean new products or whatever. Is there a difference between them?
So the way we're organized is that we have three operating companies, basically. One in Sweden, one in Denmark, and one in Norway. Yeah. And every company has its own brands. And those brands are built over decades, in some cases a century. And they're local in that they're national. So they have their relevance in a given country. So they're local champions, if you will.
Mm.
And so these brands are a source of creativity and innovation in a given country, within a given food category even. But that's quite country specific. We have ways of cooperating and sourcing ideas across countries and yeah. looking to each other, helping each other. But the brands are actually quite relevant. For Norwegians, you know, Mills Mayonnaise is a brand that everyone in Norway has heard of. And is a very that is basically the definition of mayonnaise for many people. But in Denmark, it's irrelevant.
But not in Sweden.
Not in Sweden. It is present in Sweden, but it's not a market leader.
Not as a mayonnaise, but maybe as a remoulade sauce.
That's true. Hopefully you're a buyer.
I know, I like it.
but this takes us into the leadership model. So if you have, as a kind of really strong subsidiaries with their own brands in the local markets, being relevant there, what's the role of Agra?
It's a good question. First and foremost, we believe that our brands are local. So we organize our companies around the brands. Our brands are, you know, probably our strongest source of competitive advantage. So we really organize ourselves around the brands. That means that we're producing the local taste, the local brands in the local market for the local consumer. And then we have the local people who knows the local consumer working competitively with the retailers and marketing towards the consumers. We believe in that model. and we're big enough to have scale and efficiency in all three markets to be pursuing this model. So the role of Agra is really to deliver certain services where there are obvious synergies. So Agra will do strategic sourcing, procurement of raw materials and packaging. Agra will supply IT services, accounting, treasury functions. But the rest is really done in the markets. On an Agra level, there will also be a clear strategic framework for the companies to pursue or stay within. The companies themselves develop their own strategies, but those strategies are within a framework that we as owners and as Agra believe in. So the framework will always originate from sources of strength the way we perceive it to be our strength.
This is your domain, Ulf, about studying the role of the, let's call it the corporate head office and the subsidiaries and the dynamics going back and forth.
Yeah, very, very much. And it's interesting. I mean, there's basically, there's two things that come to mind. And that is sort of what are these strategic parameters? Because I could very well see that sort of the Swedish company here might be very interested in actually entering Finland. That would be sort of kind of a natural thing. Would that be possible for them, or is sort of the national boundary sort of this is your turf, nothing else?
No, it's a good question, and it's a balancing act. Sweden or Foodmark, a company in Sweden, will have a mandate to look for companies to acquire or partner with in Sweden. But when we do larger partnerships or acquisitions, That's where the role of Agra comes in. There will likely be, touch points across the countries, and so Agra will play a role. If we're entering new markets, we've talked a lot about this with the companies, in our industry, which is very mature and not so fast growing, market positions are quite cemented. It makes sense to go into another geography if you move quite big, so that you move in and you have a sizable presence in that market.
Yes,
we think it's more difficult to go in small time and then try to build up. I think that's too late. We think that's too late for us in our industry. So if we were to go into Finland, just take your example, that would be a dialogue between Sweden and Agra would be very involved.
But
I think that those expectations have been clarified already between, the companies and Agra.
But for example, something you're well known for, except having very strong brands, is innovation. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. That's about exploration. Is that centralized or is that also decentralized? For example, to try out new products, tastes, and even marketing?
The companies are in different categories. So we might be big in mayonnaise in Norway, and then we're very big in pâtés in Denmark. And so it varies a little bit. Innovation tends to be quite local. And the reason for that is that we are strong in different categories, and innovation springs out, like it comes, flows out from the core categories. So it's logical for us that it's close to the consumer, close to the customers in each country. That being said, though, there are common themes. So we try to identify common themes or challenges or opportunities across the countries where we work in project teams across the innovation teams or marketing teams across the countries. So we do that as well. But given that we're a line organization, we function probably the best locally.
To be honest. And there is not so much synergies because of that. It's not like if you're in an industry where basically the country is the market, but the technology, the products are very much the same, sort of an innovation in one industry can be utilized in all others, or production innovations can sort of lower costs everywhere if shared. But that's, I guess, quite uncommon, because what happens in the pâté in Denmark is not sort of...
That's true. That's true. It's not as common as we would like, probably, but we see it more and more, actually. We only recently made a big investment in one production line in Sweden as we're entering into a source market that's growing, and we're seeing tendencies for the same category to show, you know, promising signs of growth in the other markets. And okay. So we're working across to leverage that production capacity and think about how can we innovate actually from that capacity into these other markets.
Great.
So we tried to do that. We're not structurally set up for this, so we have to find our way, be a little bit entrepreneurial around these opportunities, to be honest.
And just to follow up on that, and it's fascinating that you're dealing with two types of clients. It's actually the retailer and the end consumer. And the three markets are slightly different when it comes to concentrate, but at the same time, there's certain commonalities, some of them getting cross-border. How do you think about the B2C and B2B thinking on building that sustainable competitive advantage branding?
We think about it all the time. So, first of all, we have to have that connection with the consumer. So the consumers, the brands and the consumers, the fact that consumers find us attractive, appealing, the associations are right and good, the experiences with the product is consistent, so that we have that pull effect from the consumer. That is critical to our business model. But then you're right. To get to the consumer, we have to go through the retailers. The retailers are these days quite large in any geography. They tend to be three or four big players that basically all of the grocery volumes in that country run through. So they're the gatekeepers to the consumer in a way, and we have to go through them. So being relevant for the retailers, winning with the retailers, offering products that are not only attractive to consumers, but products that retailers want to sell, being a supplier that retailers see value in cooperating and partnering with is a very critical part of our sustainability over time. And that is a fascinating challenge, not always an easy challenge, but that's obviously a big part of who we are and how we will and can succeed in the long term.
Has there been more of consolidation on the retailing side over the last years?
The consolidation really happened at the beginning of this century, in the 90s, early 2000s, and it's been more stable. You have some of the online players entering more recently, but it's been quite stable and it's very consolidated. And probably still an ongoing trend towards the retailers offering more of their own products, their own brands. Mm. And so now you have the added dimension in our industry of having retail, like few but powerful retailers as your customers, but they're not only your customers, they're also, in many cases, your biggest competitor. So it's almost becoming like an art form to manage and work through this.
Has this also meant that you are now dealing with the retailers more from a central position than out in the actual companies?
No, the companies are dealing with the retailers. So the local management team, the local sales team and management team, and they're dealing with the retailers in their geographies.
So the consolidation is not really on a Nordic level. It's country by country.
It's mostly country by country. Yeah.
The growth of your category is often a reflection of the number of consumers, the creation of wealth of people eating more of maybe those categories or more expensive, but there is a limit to that growth.
We can only eat so many calories every year.
Exactly. Mm. And at the same time, you mentioned that there's coming in competitive pressure like private label. So how do you deal with those pressures and where do you find growth? Would you go into completely new categories or is it being true to your own strategy of being within the core? Or how do you think about the growth, because most companies like growth in some sort of sense. Mm.
Growth is the big question. And for us, it's important to think about organic growth and structural growth, and they have to go together. I don't think if you're quite ambitious in this industry, there has to be an element of structural growth as well. So when we think about organic growth, it's first of all, it's extremely important to be able to work with retailers in the categories that we focus on a successful basis. So the fact that retailers are competing with us, we also have other branded competitors, obviously, that makes us sharper, right? So we've had to develop our sense of what it means to win within certain categories. The retailers are generalists. They have hundreds of categories in their stores. In Norway, for instance, we're only big in really about 10 categories. So we expect of ourselves to be the champions of those categories. We should know most about those categories, and we should be the driver of innovation and growth in those categories. And we need to prove that to the retailers over time. Now, there are tough negotiations, but over time, we need to show to the retailers that we are committed and that we can help them deliver development and growth in these categories. And I think we're not done there. We can innovate from these categories. We can take one category and grow it into more than what the category historically has been defined as. So there's always opportunities or pockets of growth opportunities organically, but it's challenging. There's no doubt that it's challenging. But the combination of really good category and innovation work with really good branding work is exciting, and that's where we have our strength organically. And then in addition to that, it's thinking about who can we partner with, who can we potentially acquire, where there are synergies into the categories or otherwise. That has to be a part of the plan, I think.
I'm sure also there is somebody knocking on your door once in a while to want to buy the business, but I presume what you're saying, you're not for sale.
That's right. And I think most people know that, so not that many people knock anymore.
There is a couple of years ago, maybe more, 10, 20 years ago, there was an entry from Lidl in Norway, and the story goes that they didn't take in the Norwegian brands, very strong brands, and that could be one of the reasons why they withdraw again. Is it true? Or is it right to assume that Norwegians or consumers are very brand loyal in generally?
The numbers show us that. Lidl's entry was before my time in the industry, so I don't really know. And there are a lot of stories that go around that entry and exit. But the reality is that the private label, the level of private label, or the market share of private label, typically is a little lower in Norway than it is in other parts of like. Farther south, especially in Europe, and even in Denmark and Sweden. So from that perspective, there could be other reasons as well. But it looks like Norwegians like their brands.
Good for you.
But isn't that also? I'm not an all expert on Lidl, but what I see in commercials from Lidl in Sweden is very much Swedish meat, vegetables. Sort of on top of their own brand, so to speak, the Lidl brand. So you get both, and that might have been a lesson from Norway.
Could be. We work with Lidl both in Denmark and Sweden.
Yeah.
But it's really spot focused, like campaign and sales driven focus. It's a different strategy, obviously, and it's a different focus, different way to work with those retailers than the other more traditional retailers.
Let's switch the topic slightly, because I know that's also very close to your heart, Knut. It's about sustainability in a wide sense. And I guess it's not only about sustainability, it's about having a sustainable business model. Can you take us through how you're thinking about the whole notion of sustainability in a wider context and how it impacts all your stakeholders?
Yes, I think before it became a buzzword, we called it responsibility. And so it's for a long time been a part of who we are. You know that we sell products with a lot of fat in them, but the fact is that we need a third of the calorie intake of humans need to be fat. But it's important what kind of fat. And we are, we've been concerned with offering the right kinds of fats in a right way to consumers for a long time. And so we've had that health focus for a long time. Over the recent or the past years, sustainability has become a bigger theme and we've embraced it the way most other players in the industry have. And I will say that now, obviously, sustainability is organized under the UN Development Goals. We have a very specific and structured approach to this, a strategy that is now completely integrated with our commercial strategy. So our sustainability work and our focus on sustainability is just an integrated part of what we do, really. And I see that as something that is, you know, we taking our fair share of the responsibility. The food industry is a problem for the planet, for the resource use on the planet. And we want to be a part of the solution. We don't want to be a part of the problem. So that's number one. And number two is that consumers are more and more concerned about not only the products they buy or the brands that they buy, but who made these brands? Who are behind these brands? And they need to increasingly, they want to make sure that they're buying from good companies, companies they trust, transparent companies, and companies they understand. And for us to remain competitive and relevant over time, we have to deliver on that. So our focus on recyclability, emissions, food waste, all of the elements where we have and can make a real difference is really systemic at this stage. And that feels good. It adds a lot of meaning to me, but I know it's meaningful for people who work with us and for us. And it's been a positive adding dimension to the culture over recent years as well, as we've, you know, ratcheted up our focus on this.
And following on this, Ulf, which is fascinating, just listening to Knut, and you can see it's a passion when he speaks.
Yeah.
He also said, which sometimes is a worry when we speak to business leaders, it can also be a buzzword where people don't really know what it means and how do you really, really integrate it into the business model. What does theory tell us now? What does experience tell us about this trend, which we all agree, but some have a hard time really implement?
Yeah, but I think there's a lot of help from the UN sustainability goals, actually, because of course you can't be sustainable over all of them. But also, I mean, it's from a consumer side, I think really telling them what the company is doing and for which goals is sort of helping the companies to sort of appear more sustainable, because otherwise you can pick and choose from everything, and it's more likely that you are sort of accused of not thinking about sustainability when it comes to emissions if you're a transportation company. So that's where you have to focus. But my thinking is rather this dilemma of how far does sort of the responsibilities go? Is it to the first tier suppliers, the second tier suppliers, the third tier suppliers, and so on? But I think the sustainability goals helps.
I think so. I think they're actually quite good. Yeah. I mean, the structure, the framework is really well done. And I think in our organization, I think in many other organizations that I speak to and I know, is that the framework is a reference point in internal discussions as well, because they're logically built up. So we talk a lot about, you know, food waste under goal number X, and we talk about the footprint of our production under goal number Y, and we talk about packaging under. So there's a structure to follow, and that helps organizations become more systematic in how they approach this. So I agree with you. Mm-hmm. But do you think that in your mind that companies find it hard to go from the idea and the structure of it to actually executing on it and making a difference?
I think that's part of the problem. It's not such a problem in many Nordic companies, and that has always been sort of the case. That in Nordic companies, it's implemented all the way through. It's not just something you say. Look, we have these and these things changed, and now it's less polluting or something like that. And you don't look at what happened on the other side. In the Nordic companies, it's taken very seriously. So I mean, we can't just sort of have this thing done. We have to think about that supplier that does that. How can we make them more sustainable in some way, and so on. But I think also it's fascinating because it has become such a strong consumer trend. It's sort of, I mean you can basically explain why companies have to be sustainable by saying, well, the consumers are the ones in the end that decides if a company survives, and that's it. It's in the market. Consumers will eventually sort of abandon those that are not sustainable enough in their minds.
Consumers vote with their feet, and they have a lot of power.
And
that's fascinating. I think it's great.
Yeah.
And we have to play up to that and play with them.
Mm. Absolutely.
But is there any dilemmas between being sustainable and develop a sustainable business model? Or is that the same? Or the one the prerequisite for the other?
In our case, I think that without being sustainable in the UN sense of the word, I think it's impossible for us to have a long-term competitive advantage. I think we have no choice whatsoever, which is great, because then we know exactly what to do. We have these mayonnaise and caviar tubes that are recyclable and from recyclable material. And when consumers know, they love it. We get feedback. We see that when we offer packaging that is just more sustainable and we're helping consumers take steps to reduce food waste, that is, it's welcomed. We get feedback and we see it in the numbers even. And that's because, you know, some of the steps we do take, we also communicate, obviously. Mm-hmm. And we get rewarded from it. And that's rewarding in and of itself.
And it's taking care of another sustainability goal for the people that work there, and that there is sort of an economic wealth created. So that's brilliant.
Mm. We have been through some dramatic times the last 6-9 months, particularly due to the invasion of Ukraine, which has had multiple effects beyond the devastating personal effects of people in Ukraine. But it also has impact on prices and also some of your suppliers. How do you deal with such a disruption, which suddenly just hits you and may impact the way you run the business and even the brands and the consumers?
Mm. Yeah, there's been really no business as usual since the outbreak of COVID, and then we came, you know, the disastrous invasion of Ukraine, and we had a new period of uncertainty with regards to can we get what we need, raw materials and packaging. We need stuff every day into our factories, and things are, you know, being pumped out of the factories all the time, every day, and so. Making sure the resilience of the supply chain was really there was and still is of utmost importance to us. And then came inflation, and we felt like we saw this quite early as a buyer of lots of different raw materials and packaging that price increases were coming. And obviously, it's concerning that prices can rise that much in such a short period of time, especially given, you know, the recent history with no inflation, basically, that we have behind us. So this is a game changer for us, and it's difficult. And we've had to raise prices a lot more than we're comfortable with and then we want to, from a competitive point of view and also from a societal point of view. We're part of seeing what's happening to food prices in our part of the world and the rest of the world, frankly. So it's challenging.
But I presume one of the things is then to have built up long-term relationship with the supply chain and having that good dialogue with the clients, that being the customers, both the B2C and not least B2B, I presume is.
So important to have been working proactively with identifying risk in the supply chain ahead of a crisis. So much easier to work with it during a crisis. And in our case, we're not the biggest buyer of a lot of these things in Europe and in Scandinavia, but we're but we have relationships that have been cultivated over years and sometimes decades. And we also have alternatives. We have alternative suppliers. We have alternative raw materials that we can switch to in a crisis. So there are a number of contingency plans that help us feel more secure, even though there's a crisis. And so far, the supply chain has been operating. And I'm positively, you know, surprised almost by the fact that the food supply chains in the world have operated quite efficiently through both the COVID crisis and post the invasion of Ukraine.
We're sitting here in the studio of BI, and one of our roles is to educate next generation and also maybe people who would like to work for a fascinating house of brands like Agra's brands in diverse countries. Do you have any reflection ideas how we should make our students even more relevant than we maybe do today?
The combination of real world experience and what you learn at school or at university is just, to me, is quite critical as you're building your career. I was fortunate enough to be first 4 years at university, then working for 3 years, and then back to university for an MBA. And what I realized then was that real world experience and then taking that back to academia and combining it with academia made me just learn so much more. So if there's a way to gain practical experience while you're studying and maybe, you know, testing out industries or themes or topics that you think you could be interested in, I'd highly recommend it because it's so much easier to learn and appreciate what you're learning too.
I think what you're saying is, how do you make the academic stuff more relevant? Something you can kind of put your angle on and stuff like that. Is that right? But Ulf, what's your reflection now? We're listening to Knut here now, who's running a fabulous Nordic companies, and listen to what's kind of your take on this?
I think it's very fascinating because I mean most of my research are on manufacturing companies in industry, I mean the typical Nordic ones, in that sense, and how much the upstream means, and a lot of the things that I've looked at, subsidiary autonomy importance, and how that sort of forms strategy in the bigger company. And then I actually did a study on fast consumer goods in Germany, where the retailers have actually, over the last decade, become global firms, and how this output sales autonomy that you had has been more and more centralized to deal with these retailers, in a sense, and how that have changed the subsidiaries' possibilities important subsidiaries are suddenly not, it's only because of market, it's not because of things they do, and that is fascinating to see that you have a different type of balance and much more country specific, but at the same time, this central strategic.
So it sounds like the firms that you studied had to were forced to centralize their sales focus in order to cater to the
retailers
now cross country or global retailers.
Yeah, so it was much more. I mean, keeping it at the local level was sort of, well, it has never been much of possibilities of getting synergies, but being local has been the important thing. But now there were sort of forces towards sort of, no, we're going to have the same type of trade deals in Germany, France, wherever. So you deal with us on a central level. And that was fascinating. That doesn't seem to have hit in the same way for your business.
No, it hasn't, because the retailers in Scandinavia aren't structured that way or aren't operating in that way, I guess.
No, and I think that's interesting because it would be a very different ball game, maybe trying to internationalize into Germany. I mean, that's just speculations, of course, but it would suddenly change the whole picture. The new customers, the new retailers would be a different type of breed.
Definitely.
we are coming to end, but what I hear is basically summing up what you said. What you hear is that Agra is adapting to environment, and that's how they've done it here. So looking into the future, then, are you going to become even more global, going to Finland, as we discussed, or what's next up now?
I don't know, Thomas. Maybe I should take some advice from you. To be honest, I'm excited about the future. We know that we have some opportunities and some real challenges. I talked about the growth and elements ahead of us. I think it's going to be a combination of continuing to grow and strengthen from our core, and then seizing on what I believe will be more consolidation, partnership opportunities ahead of us. I don't know exactly what it's going to be like, but I'm excited to find out. I don't think we're going to look exactly what we look like today in 5 or 10 years' time. And I don't know what it is, but I'm excited to see what it can be.
With those words, I think we can end on a very good note. And thank you for a very good conversation. And I hope your listener enjoyed it. Thank you. Until next time.
Thank you.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.